In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to another episode of Strange Planet. And if you'd like to get deeper into Strange Planet, you might want to consider becoming a premium subscriber. It's real easy to do. In fact, the link is right there in the episode notes, but it's strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. You get access to commercial-free listening, bonus episodes, a subscription to my monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, discounts on merchandise, and much more. strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. All right, we're going to take a look at a very interesting ancient Peruvian structure on this episode. It's called Kiarumiak, and here to tell us about the lost secrets of this shadow machine is Dr. Arlen Andrews. He is an engineer. He is a writer of both science fiction and nonfiction. He worked with the White House Science Office and the White Sands Missile Range. He's also the founder and director of Sigma, the science fiction think tank providing
free futurism consulting to the federal government. And his latest book is, once again, Kiarumiyuk, Lost Secrets of the Shadow Machine, an ancient enigma of Peru revealed. Arlen, how are you? Welcome.
Doing well, Richard. Thank you for having me.
So tell me everything that you think is important. Give me the sort of the raw data, the dimensions and so forth, location of Kiarumiyuk, this structure in Peru.
Okay, first let me show you the book. There's an illustration of the sculpture itself. It's about 8.5 feet wide. It's about 3 feet tall, 2 feet deep, and it's tilted back approximately 45 degrees. This is carved into a large limestone outcropping in a park that's about 30 miles north of Cusco, Peru, in the sacred valley of the Inca. And it's beautiful. It's enigmatic. I think I'm the first person to look at it and see what it really was, which is a solar calendar. And as an engineer, I took these dimensions, and I had Brian Forster, who's a famous guide in the area, go back several times and take hundreds of measurements. And with that, I was able to construct a three-dimensional model on CAD, computer-aided design. Then I had my own little Kiarumiyuk I could play with time to day, night, tilted around, moving around, until I was able to duplicate the shadows that I had seen the first visit. And I went back two more times to validate this. And I've been able to prove that it was a solar calendar.
So this was it 2012 you went and found this?
The first time we were there in 2012, I was on my way to another famous carving, rock carving, which is called Soedi Stone. That's something else for another time. Along the way, we saw a picture of this, a signpost leading to this Kiarumiyuk. Went back the next day on April the 10th, I think it was, 2012. And I was captured by the shape. There was no explanation there. There were no signs about what it was. So while my son, Dr. Sean Andrews, and Brian Forster went and explored other parts of that archaeological park, I sat there on a stone about 25 feet east of Kiarumiyuk and looked at this. I call it a stone rainbow because it is in a rainbow shape.
Right.
The Kiarumiyuk name itself is a Quechua Indian name or native name, meaning the stone that belongs to the moon or the moonstone. And they think, a legend has it, that it's in the shape of the moon. They think it's the like a partial shape of the moon. And so we looked at it that day. And I sat there for a couple of hours and watched the shadows play across this. I was just totally fascinated by it. So went back to Cusco that night, and I got online, and I began to look for it because I said, I'm sure there were books about this thing. I really want to read those. There was nothing. Online, I found a government pamphlet that said, there's a rock out there. It's carved. Has something to do with a ritual religion of the moon, a feminine shrine of some sort. And that's it.
So obviously the people that named it really didn't understand. Obviously they came around much later than when this was constructed because they misnamed it. It has nothing to do with the moon. It is a solar calendar.
Now, yeah, we can't say that they didn't use it that way afterwards. There's no record of when it was built or who did it. Now, it's found in the Valley of the Inca, so people think it might be Inca, and it might be. I don't know. But when the Spaniards got there, the conquistadors, nobody ever mentioned this site. Nobody knew about it, and it was only in the, I guess, the 1800s or 1900s sometime that somebody even went there and talked about it. In my book, I listed every single reference that I could find over a five-year period that even referenced Kiarumiyuk, and all they ever said was, it's there, it might be astronomical, that's it.
So
there was no information about it at all.
The moment you saw it, even before you did the CAD rendering or modeling, you said that's a solar calendar. Why would you assume that's a solar calendar?
Because of the parabolic arc in the middle. That's a parabola in the middle. And that's characteristic of all sundials. If you see that, there's the arc in the middle of it. And so I thought, okay, there must be a place then for a post, a pointer, a gnomon, as it's called, that every other sundial in the world has. We got up there and looked, and there's some cracks in the floor, but there's no place to put a post. So when I got my three-dimensional model working, I put a post in it, and a post didn't work. I found out that it was the shape of the structure itself, the way the shadows aligned, overhead shadows came down and touched things. I was able to show that this thing is going to predict the solstice, beginning and end of the year. So with a very crude model, I predicted that at a certain time that the solstice was going to be to the left of this wedge at the top. And I asked Brian Forster to go out, and he went out and photographed it on that day at that time. And sure enough, we were right.
That's the June 21st solstice, which is our summer solstice. It would be their winter solstice.
That's beginning, the end of the year, beginning of the year. And there's a symmetrical occurrence at the December solstice 6 months later. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But that crude model showed that it worked. I said, good. So he took a lot more measurements, and I was able to refine the model and then look at it every single day of the year and see what happens. And I was able to reproduce the shadows at certain times. Now, not only the shadow moves across the center of the thing, and again, this is a no pointer. It's all in the shape of the sculpture itself. Somebody was genius to think of this, to build one without a pointer in it. And I maintain, at least based on my own research, there's not been another solar calendar in history ever built that way, ever designed that way. So this one, I think it's unique in the world.
So is there any writing on it, any inscription?
No, it's carved. When you look at it from a distance, it looks pretty. It looks smooth and fine. There are some sharp edges, but most of it is chipped out. You can see there's tens of thousands of chipping places where they use stones or maybe chisels to carve things around. There's nothing written around it at all. Now, a few hundred yards up the valley there's a cave that's got some kind of caveman type paintings inside of it. But I don't think that those paintings have anything to do with the culture that built this sophisticated calendar. Downstream of us, there are megalithic ruins remaining where there used to be a building. So there must have been people who stayed there, and somebody would go up probably every day and look at this calendar and pick out particularly important things, like maybe ritual days, at least the solstices and equinoxes you can have. And they probably use it as a monthly calendar as well. The Inca did have a 12-month calendar, and they had 4 days at the end of the year, the June solstice, when the sun, every day about noontime, the sun is in the same spot for about 4 days. It doesn't change. Even today in Peru, they celebrate that. They call it the Inti Rami, the celebration of the sun. For 4 days, they have one heck of a festival nationwide. Believe me, it's loud and colorful and fun to be there.
Yeah, it goes like 24/7, right? Even when the sun sets, it's still going.
Yeah, I went back in 2017, the day after the solstice occurred. And so we were there during that four-day period. I went twice that particular time. We took videos and photographs to show that these shadows were in the places that the model said they would be. Along the way, I discovered two other things that have never been pointed out. One is that there is a hole carved. There's a hole carved up here on the side in the rock.
Right.
And during the solstice, at a certain time, the sun shines through that hole onto the sculpture itself at a certain spot. The interesting thing is there's an overhead shadow that comes down at the same time and points to that shadow, points to the sun image right there. And then the feet here at this thing, the feet shadows change. One goes into sunlight and one goes into darkness. And all these things happen within a few minutes of each other. And so when you have four different phenomena occurring at the same time, or very similar, or very almost simultaneously, and that happens over a period of 4 days every day, the person who was watching it, the Inca called them the Yanka, that person can say, this is the solstice. This is the beginning of the year, or the end of the year, whichever way you would look at it.
So it's like the crystal ball dropping at Times Square on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, except there are four of them here, or maybe five. It depends on which way you want to look at it.
Right.
So I think it was very sophisticated. And as I mentioned in the book, as an engineer, of course, I looked at this thing and said, my gosh, somebody had to sit down and design this and draw out and everything else. And I don't know how in the world, we know they didn't have advanced mathematics. We don't think geometry, trigonometry during those times, Inca time or before. My wife looked at it and said, well, hon, if it was up to me, I would make a mud model of it, a terracotta model, clay model of it, right next to the same spot, maybe on a platform. I would tweak that mud model until those shadows did what I wanted them to do. Then we'd tell the guys, say, okay, measure off of this and go up there and carve it in stone. She said, it's a lot easier to change mud than it is stone if you make a mistake. So I give her credit for that. I hadn't thought of that.
If that sundial were placed anywhere else up and down the Inca Valley, would it work?
No. No, it's if you move it, I think a mile or two away, it probably would not work. I haven't calculated how precise it is for that, but it can't be located 50 miles away. No. Now, in doing the research, there are a lot of books about Inca astronomy, and I bought a whole library of them over the years. And they said there was one Inca at a certain time, right before the Spaniards came, that proclaimed that he wanted calendars built all over the Tiwantinsuyo, the Inca kingdom. And so when I read that, I said, well, good. There's probably other ones like this scattered around Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, somewhere. But no, nothing that I could ever find. Now, if they do find another one, I'd be very happy to be contradicted on that. But as far as I could find, that was the only one. So you'd think if that was part of his proclamation, that typical design tweaked for another location would be found elsewhere, but it's not.
Right.
This is the only one I know of in the whole world.
You mentioned, I think you called it the shaman's seat or the shaman's stone. This is where the Yanka would sit and look and watch the sundial?
Yes. The day we were there, there's a stone, a big stone, about 25 feet east of the sculpture itself. You can't see it here, but this is taken from there. The picture's taken from that spot. It's very convenient. You sit there and you're just about perpendicular to it and at the same height. Because the sculpture itself is 8 feet off the ground, so nobody's going to go up and touch it. It's 8 feet high, and it's a hard climb up the rocks, believe me, to get into it. And I did do that. It's a dangerous climb, too. The person would sit there and look at it directly. Now, the reason they located this design in that spot, I think, is several reasons. First off, you had the big flat rock it was carved into. Then you had this, what I call the shaman stone, or the Yanka seat, 25 feet directly from it, so you could sit there and look at it. And then right behind there's a stream and a waterfall. So if you wanted to have a house there or a temple or a building or something, there's water. And that's a beautiful area. So all these things together, people probably looked at it and said, hey, if we're going to do this, this is a great spot for it. We got a place to look at it from. We have the big, rather flat area to carve on. We have overhanging rocks that provide the shadows that indicate exactly when we're supposed to look at it. And we got water, so that's probably why. Now, the stones downstream are megalithic. They don't look Inca at all. And some people claim that there are three different kinds of architecture in the Sacred Valley. There's the Inca stuff, which are stones about so big that are piled up, and they're irregular stones. But the megalithic stones are beautifully cut, smooth, and you can see those in Cusco in the Coricancha, the temple that's now a church. And above them are Inca stones, which are obviously a different kind of architecture, and we think maybe a different culture did that. So I don't know. I don't know when this thing was built. I tried to date it using that hole with the sun shining through at the solstice, but my measurements are only approximate. All my models are approximate because we don't have perfect dimensions of the thing. But looking at that hole still works probably back 2,000 years. But again, the model is not that accurate, so I can't definitely say that it's 2,000 years old. I don't think it's that old. If you compare the wear on the sculpture itself, the sharp edges and everything else, and compare those to other weathered stones around Cusco and other places, this is not weathered as much as other stones. So it might be the age, it might be the weather, it might be the type of stone. But it's at least 500 years old because that's when the Inca Empire was destroyed by the conquistadors. And it could be thousands.
You mentioned that, okay, so that we've got the winter solstice, the summer solstice. You mentioned it may also mark the months. Are there etches or lines within the parabolic carving?
Yes. If you'll look here, there's almost like marks on a wristwatch. You'll see the
right
little marks along the edges. Those are triangular shadow areas made by, there are planes in there. There are planes in it carved this way and another one carved slightly above it this way. And where those intersect, that provides a marker like on an old analog wristwatch or a clock.
So it's going to mark the beginning of a month, the end of a month, the beginning of a new month. It's going to mark.
It's all, especially right now, since the model is approximate, but those markers and halfway in between those markers, it seems to be significant. And the other thing is, the most important thing is there's a shadow that traverses across this open area I call the bowl. This is an open area. There's a vertical shadow that comes down. And that shadow tells the date and where it intersects one of these little markers along the edge is significant, yes. And the book explains all of it. It gets quite a bit of detail. And some of it is reproducible right now. Some of it, since I wasn't there for the whole year, is not reproducible because it's only speculation. Right. Identify the speculations and identify what is permanent.
Dr. Arlen Andrews stays with us. The book is Kia Rumiak, Lost Secrets of the Shadow Machine, an ancient enigma of Peru revealed. Back with more of our conversation right after these.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Lincoln County 911. There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries, or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Every Town podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? You're listening to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Engineer Dr. Arlen Andrews is with us, writer of science fiction and nonfiction. In fact, he's working on a trilogy, the first book in the trilogy, Thaw, about life during the upcoming ice age, and the website sigmaforum.org. That's the sci-fi think tank that he is founder of, and they consult with governments, sigmaforum.org. How did the ancients or the different civilizations, how did they use the sun calendar? Aside from telling them, okay, so it's the solstice, but what practical purpose did it have?
Well, almost all ancient cultures, and even ours up until the 1800s, was based primarily on agriculture. And they needed to know when the year started. They needed to know approximately when to plant and when to harvest. And that occurred in almost every culture around the world. Some people built it in places like Stonehenge in England, great big places. People built it in the deserts of Arabia and in Egypt and all over North America. You know, there American Indians had places like this. Sometimes they would use wooden posts. And sometimes, again, in Stonehenge, they used megaliths to do it. And they probably, some of them worshiped the sun and the planets and everything as gods. And so more than likely, there was a religious aspect to it, too. But somebody recognized that, hey, it happens this way. And 3 months later, we know we need to plant. And 4 months later, we need to harvest. And those people were, I would say, scientists or engineers or technicians. They built instruments. And that's what Kiaromiak is. I think it's an instrument. What I compare it with, if you want to think about, the Spaniards talk about when they first took over Cusco, before they destroyed them, there were big towers around where hundreds or thousands of people could gather and watch the shadows of the solstice, and they could mark it and have a big celebration about it. Now, the people who lived there first in the country were worshipers of the moon in some fashion, but the Inca culture, when they conquered everything, they brought in a solar culture. They worshiped the sun. Now, we say worship, but we don't know. It might be they used it, they utilized it. So the solar calendar was imposed upon everybody, even the people before who used to keep track of the moon. So anyhow, in Cusco, they had these great big towers that hundreds of people could watch the shadows, and they could say, ha-ha, this is a solstice, this is an equinox, and that's it. Of course, conquistadors destroyed those and used the stones to build other things. This one at Kiaromiak was small, 8.5 feet wide. It's the difference between Big Ben clock in London the whole world can see, and your grandfather clock in the hallway. This one right here is built for probably one person, maybe just a few people to look at. It's a pocket watch example. It's small.
Right. And then they would go somewhere, I don't know, to a village and proclaim, maybe from a tower or something, the solstice has
perhaps the building downstream here, a few hundred yards downstream where that building was, it's destroyed now, megalithic ruins. That might have been the place where when the Yonka saw it's time, he would come down and say, okay, now tell everybody. And maybe he sent out runners, or maybe people came to that place, hey, is it time yet? Do we plant yet? What's going on? And, you know, hierarchies and positions of power, people probably had rituals and all kind of ceremonies they did at the time. But the important thing was there was a scientific instrument there that told them what day of the year it was, what the season was, and what they did with it after that, I don't know. That's why I'm hoping to bring this to the attention of real archaeologists, people who've spent life studying these things, because once they know this, they could probably figure out, oh, that's what it means. And we know what happens after that. There is an archaeologist in Peru right now. I sent the book to a few months ago, and he wrote back last week and said, well, he hasn't had time to check the details yet. He's in Peru. I asked him if he would please go by Kiarumiak while he's there, take pictures, the date and time, so I could check those against the model. I always need to tweak the model if it's wrong. So I'm hoping to bring it to the attention of the real establishment. I have been told that there's at least one archaeologist who refutes me, but I have not received any word of that. And I would certainly love to have the opinions of professionals, because they might refute my speculations in some of the details, but you can't refute the shadows. They are there. These right. things do happen. I was there to see it.
Right. So if you were to run your CAD, your 3D CAD model, 365 days, and I understand you don't have precise measurements, but it's giving you some outputs. Do you have any speculation as to what else the sundial, aside from the solstices and marking the months, what it might tell you?
There's at least the equinox. The equinox shadows occur in exactly the same spot every year. I mean, 6 months apart, the shadows return to a certain spot. So it's at least the equinoxes. Now, there is a natural crack in the bottom of this sculpture, and part of it has been worked. It looks to me like work to be able to put a vase or a pot or something down in it. I speculate, I couldn't work it out for the book, but I speculate you could probably put a pot of water there, and at a certain time, the reflection of the sun off of that would hit and go up to one of these little markers on the side. And that date is probably important. I couldn't quite work it out. I didn't want to speculate exactly what that was, but that was a date of some importance, because they had to work on the stone crack and it points over toward one of the markers. And I speculated that sunlight at an angle coming in hit it, probably lit that up. And that was another date of importance. I don't know what it was for.
Right.
But that's why I want some project someday to take a 3D scan of that entire 80 foot wide, 60 foot high stone of the entire thing, then make the model and run a perfect CAD model of it. And then you can see everything.
Yeah.
The overhead stones and the side stones cast other kinds of shadows. An important one that I came up with and I bring out in the book is that at least during the solstice and maybe other times of the year, some pictures indicate it looks like it might happen other times. It appears that the shadow, a large shadow of a condor, the sacred bird of the Andean cultures, comes down and lands on top of that sculpture. And you can see the upthrust feathers. You can see the neck. You can see the eye. You can see the beak. And in Indian cultures, the condor is sacred. It represents the sky and the heavens. The puma or cougar represents the ground, and the serpent represents the underground. Now, another thing that appears to happen when I had pictures taken at the December solstice, it looks like there's the shadow of a puma appears. The condor doesn't, but a puma appears pointing in the other direction. Now, that is a theme that's carried on in other parts of the Sacred Valley, a condor in one direction, a puma in the other direction. It took some kind of skill to work this out, where one month you have a condor and another month the shadows are a puma. So I think it's a work of genius, a work of art. It's a work of genius, and it needs to be recognized. I hope it would be a World Heritage Site myself, because I think it's unique. The tourism, they can really use the tourism. The people around there are dirt poor. And it would be great to have another, it's not going to be Machu Picchu, but it could be very interesting. In fact, don't want to denigrate anybody, but I thought Machu Picchu was overrated. It was great. I had read engineering books on the hydraulic engineering, went there, and it's fascinating. But as far as just visiting and looking at it, it's fine. Kirumak is more interesting. Ollantaytambo is more interesting. And there are other ones around there that, to me, are more interesting. I did not return to Machu Picchu when I went back in 2017. I wanted to see other places.
Arlen, we'll take another time out. Back with more in a moment.
Okay.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Dr. Arlen Andrews is with us, engineer, writer of science fiction, nonfiction. And again, we're talking about this remarkable Peruvian sculpture, Kirumiak. And the book is Kirumiak, Lost Secrets of the Shadow Machine, An Ancient Enigma of Peru Revealed. Has anyone, well, I think you mentioned this, but I'm intrigued by the idea that no engineer has utilized CAD, you know, taken precise measurements of, I don't know, Stonehenge, the pyramids, or whatever, and then using that as a model, like, try to figure out what else these things do. No one else has done that.
They, on the big things like the pyramid, yeah, they have done that. I mean, that's done. But on, I don't know of any kind of, or any type of other sculpture they've ever done that with. I mean, certainly never done it with Kiromiak, and I haven't read of any other place where they use CAD to work out the shadows of a of an ancient site. It should be. I mean, I wanted to. My first thought was to build a three-dimensional model, a physical model, and have it a regular full-size model at my home to play with. But this is can't be done. I said, well, if I have a 3D CAD model, I can do anything in the world with it. One thing I wanted to mention, since we said it before, I wanted to mention the shadow of the condor. Perhaps you can see it.
It's above the parabolic. It's above the actual calendar.
It's above it.
Yeah,
and it seems to land on it.
Yes.
And over the next hour or so, it encompasses the entire sculpture. And up there at the top, at the top, there's a December. There's a puma appears. It's not quite as dramatic as that one, but the puma appears in the other direction.
I know you've been on Ancient Aliens, but you know, you have an engineer's mind. You know what people are, even ancient cultures, are capable of doing. You get frustrated by all of the, oh, this was constructed by aliens business.
Yes, I think that denigrates the humans that did the work. There's no evidence at all of anything that any alien ever built at all on Earth. Now, that's another subject for another talk sometime, but I was a UFO consultant for many years for APRO and MUFON, and I'm glad to see the current UFO stuff coming out, because I believe a lot of it. But as far as the ancients go, our ancient ancestors had brains as big as ours, and there were some of them were just as smart as we are, and are smarter. I think the person who designed and built this Kiromiak was smarter than I am, I'll tell you. I wouldn't know how to do it today if you gave me the task. I wouldn't even know what to look for. But I've given talks before, and people say, well, you know, the pyramids had to be ancient aliens to do that, because we humans can't do that stuff. And I said, well, let me ask a question to the audience. How many of you people down here know how to build a 50-story skyscraper? Anybody? And make sure there's not any contractors in the area. And most people don't have a clue how to start. I said, well, would you go downtown and you can see hundreds of stories, 50 stories, 20 stories all the time? Somebody built those. You don't know how they did it. So why would you think aliens did it? My wife had another good observation. She's kind of my go-to person for when I get off too crazy on things. She said, look at it this way. Why did they need ancient aliens? We didn't need ancient aliens. Our history is about 6,000 years old, 6,000 years. In that 6,000 years, except for the wheel and fire, and which is probably older, and a few things like that, we can trace the origins of every invention back to a particular person or a particular culture, or, you know, pretty close to a certain part of the world. No place in there did an alien come in. And now the ancient people, they were around probably 10,000 years before this civilization. They had just as much time as we did to come up with things. So we didn't need aliens. Like she said, why did they need aliens to do it? Now, there are a lot of the mysteries, I think, can be addressed kicking the can down the road and say, okay, there was a civilization before ours that knew a lot of other stuff. They knew very well how to carve stones and move stones around and do that kind of thing. And I do believe that. I think previous civilizations were wiped out at the Younger Dryas and maybe other earthquakes and volcanoes and comet impacts in the past. But human beings did it. There's no reason to think. I was at the pyramid in Egypt one time, and the guy who became a friend later came out and said, oh, I know how this was all built. They ground it up and they made geopolymer and they poured all these things and they cast it and they put it in place.
I think I talked to that guy. Yes, it's pre.
Oh, Lord. Well, I'll tell you, you walk inside the Great Pyramid there or on around it, and you see every damn stone is different. They're not cast.
It's not pre-poured concrete, no.
They weren't poured. There's a quarry not far away where you can see where they came from. So they're not going to quarry in a ground. But it's so ridiculous. People get frustrated because they can't figure out how it's done. But again, those same people can't look at a modern building and tell you how it's done either. So a friend of mine, I won't give his name because he'll be on your show sometime. Might have been already. He's was involved 25 years worth of precision engineering and machining, turning out aerospace products to the 10,000th of an inch. Perfect, you know.
Right. Can't slip a piece of paper between them.
thousands of times he said, you know, and then there was a professor of history on YouTube that comes out with a bunch of really nasty, critical YouTube videos about him saying, oh, he's a liar, he's a cheat, phony, and everything else. And my friend says, you know, after looking at that, rather than respond to this fellow, I said, you know, I've had hundreds of meetings with customers who accepted our parts, and we've talked about precision. And I can't remember one time that we invited a history professor to come in and give his comments about our work. So that's it. My problem is, and I said this before on some movies and TV shows, I respect archaeologists. I mean, people who spend 50 years working out the grammar and syntax of hieroglyphics and stuff. I respect that. I'm so happy that people do that. But when it gets down to getting your hands dirty and designing things and building things and laying things out in a shop, you need technicians, you need artisans, you need artists, you need engineers, you need scientists to look at these things. And I wrote articles about it before, the limits of belief. I believe as long as the people stay in their own swim lane, I respect it, ultimate respect. But when they start talking about things outside of that, then you don't have to believe it. When you have an professor of history talking about how to make precision stone tools, you can be skeptical of it. Unless he has a background in it and has done it, you don't have to believe it. The same way with historians, archaeologists, anybody else, or engineers. You wouldn't ask me as an engineer for my opinions of some nuance of history, some battle somewhere, or some piece of pottery or whatever, because I wouldn't know anything about it. I wasn't trained in it. I don't think that way. But you need to blend these skills together. All other scientists, scientific fields, welcome welcome amateurs. Imagine astronomy without amateur astronomers. I mean, right. Half of the discoveries have been made by amateurs. Right. But archaeology apparently does not welcome outsiders. And that's why I'm still waiting for the blank storm to hit me on this one. And that's why I went to a couple of professors early on when I first found these things, the University of Texas, and I asked about it. And they were nice. They said, well, you hadn't heard about it, so we're not really interested. We have other things to do. Okay, fair enough. But this one, with the book, I'm kind of sticking it in people's faces. Okay, I'll make claims in here. Some of the claims might be outrageous. Some of them might be wrong. But the darn shadows are there. You can't argue with those. I'll take you there every year, June the 21st, and I'll show you that what happens. And I want interdisciplinary work. And like I said, my goal is hopefully real archaeologists will get involved in this thing, and they can tell me if I'm wrong, or they can say what these people would do with this information, or maybe what culture built it. There might be some other examples of a similar type of thing that the Inca or the people before them built it. There's all kind of stuff to discover. An example, the Suwayi stone, the stone I wrote some articles about. It's a stone a few miles up the road from this one. I went there in 2012 to take measurements and do some things. I found out it's a 13-foot stone. It's got hundreds of carvings on it. And you pour water on it, and it runs down channels and stuff. Well, an interesting thing occurs. There are some channels at the bottom that looked about like this. It looked like fingers interleaved with each other. And I started looking into that. And that right there is a type of irrigation that was done on the western side of the Indies thousands of years ago. And the technology was forgotten when those cultures collapsed. So for hundreds of years, nobody knew about this stuff. The Swede stone had it on there the whole time. It was only in the 1800s or 1900s. I have the date somewhere. That technology was rediscovered. And it's a method of irrigation that's now used over South America and in China and other places of the world. It's 6 or 8 inch deep channels with mounds of dirt in between. And it creates a microclimate. And during night in the desert, it keeps moisture there. So you can have a very, very high productive agricultural system there in the middle of the desert. Mm-hmm. And those people, ancient people, had it on the other side of the Andes during that time. It was forgotten. But that there was a lost technology. And it is there on Swede. And it was there the whole time for people to look at. So my point is, okay, let's look at other things. What else was forgotten? There might be other things on that stone or other places around the world we need to look at as an engineer, as an agriculturist, as an irrigation person. I mean,
yes.
Who knows? There's knowledge out there that's in stone that we need to look at.
Hiding in plain sight. Well, once you get those precise measurements and run your CAD model again, there may be more chapters to write on the shadow machine.
I think so. I call it a shadow machine because it produces, you put in sunlight and you get shadows. That's what a machine does. You put an input and you have an output.
Kia Rumiak, Lost Secrets of the Shadow Machine, an Ancient Enigma of Peru Revealed. How do we get a copy, Arlen?
It's on Amazon. And other places, I think, the other online places. Unfortunately, it's not. We couldn't do a Kindle version because of the so many pictures and drawings and stuff inside. So it's available in this trade paperback on Amazon and probably Barnes & Noble and other places.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to doing an update with you when you get those precise measurements. We'll get, I guess you have to get Brian Forrester on, get on his case and get that done.
Well, he's been there a lot of times for me. I don't think there's many more measurements he can make.
Arlen, thank you so much for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.